Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Listen to them. Children of the night. What music, Dave.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
You wouldn't be able to do these awful things to me if I weren't still in this chair.
But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
Who's in the box?
Put the gun down, David.
No, what's in the box?
Wolves have a territorial range of about 300 miles and a kill range of 30. If we're close to their den, and if we're within that radius, they'll come after us.
How can we tell if we're close?
We can't.
What in God's name are you talking about?
Your son, Mr. Thorne. The son of the devil.
You're insane.
He must die, Mr. Thorne!
You do not want to go that way.
What's that way?
Officer, sir, you do not want to go that way. We're going to the mall.
Hello, Dexter Morgan.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going?
It's going well.
Excellent. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone, this is Dave.
Hey, how's it going?
I feel like I've been punched by a giant monkey, but otherwise I'm all right.
There you go. And in the Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Very busy. We have co-host Mike from New York who will be joining shortly. He's on his way from his employment to home, and he'll join up during the call. And after we introduce the film, and I give a little rundown on the film, I then have to drop out for the critique because I have to go back to work, a big project at work. But Eric will take over as the main host, and we'll hopefully keep everybody in line for whatever.
Yes, right. And,
but I will come back on at the very end to give my final thoughts as well. So a couple of things. Let's do some house cleaning. First off, Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can find it on iTunes and on Stitcher.
Excellent. Very good. Very good. And Abe, you do things.
It's called The Real Movie Reviewer. It's a multi-genre blog. Best way to find it is go to Dark Discussion's main page and look on your right-hand side. And there'll be a link to the blog through there, along with everything else that's so far, as well as a few other blogs and friends of ours if you want to pay them a visit.
Excellent. And Chrissy, you do things.
I do. I write short, dark fiction, and you can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com.
Yep, very good. And Mike, co-host Mike, does a blog called UnnaturalSelections.com, which he has a new blog out on the anniversary of Buffy, the Vampire Slayer. And you can go there and check it out. If you forget any of the links, as Abe said, you can go to darkdiscussions.com, and on the front page on the right are links to all these things. Also, you can listen to all our podcasts directly from there. And at the bottom of every page, there's links to the Facebook group, iTunes, Stitcher, and so forth. We do have a Patreon account as well. There's a big button on the Facebook page as well as on darkdiscussions.com right at the top, which if you so desire, you can donate to the podcast.
And welcome to another edition of Terror Tantrums. My name is Patrick Lacey. I'm a horror author and longtime listener to Dark Discussions. If you're new to the podcast, this is a segment where I take a look at a slightly lesser known or obscure horror film and give it an hopefully unbiased review, as usually I'm seeing it for the first time. That is, in fact, the case this week. This is a film called Rawhead Rex, released in 1986, directed by a man named George Pavlov. I hope I'm saying that right. He also directed a film the previous year, 1985, called Transmutations, which I believe was released by Scream Factory. So you might know him from that. But more importantly, I think, and more infamously, the screenplay was written by a little-known guy named Clive Barker, who had recently, at the time, had his short story collections published, Books of Blood. And so one of the most popular short stories in that is called Rawhead Rex, and that is what this is kind of sort of based on, except, plot spoiler, it is much, much different, and the tone of the film is extremely different. So here's a quick little synopsis, and we'll dive right into it. It says, Ireland will never be the same after Rawhead Rex, a particularly nasty demon, is released from his underground prison by an unwitting farmer. The film follows Rex's cross-country rampage while a man struggles to stop it. Okay, so that is literally all you need to know, because that sums up this film perfectly. And we'll get into the actual film in a second, but the reason I chose this particular one is about a week prior, as of this recording, I traveled to Ireland with my girlfriend and visited a man by the name of Matt Hayward, who is a professional touring musician. He plays with people like Alice in Chains and other famous bands, but he's also a horror author, and I have just recently finished co-writing a novel with him, a horror novel, and to celebrate, I took a trip over there from Boston to kind of celebrate and send said novel out to publishers. So I wanted to, when I came home, I was planning to watch Leprechaun. This is about 2 weeks out from St. Paddy's Day, so I wanted an Irish-themed horror film. I was thinking that or The Hallow, just to kind of get in the mood or whatever and keep the trip going, because I was kind of sad to leave. It's a very, very lovely place. If you a PSA, if you ever get a chance to travel there, it's gorgeous. But while in the local pub, in which we spent plenty of time, Matt Hayward informed me that Rawhead Rex was filmed in the area, and a lot of it was filmed right outside in the fields behind that pub. So I kind of got obsessed with it. I had seen this film on the shelves as a kid in my local video store. I can remember the VHS cover and then the DVD cover. When one of my favorite video stores is going out of business, I remember there was only a few horror movies left, and I narrowed them down because I wanted to get one on sale. The first was Dog Soldiers, which is what I ended up getting, and that's a really, really good werewolf movie. Maybe I'll do a review of that, actually. That would be good. But also Rawhead Rex, and I don't know why I didn't get that one, because I had read the description. It has a cool monster-type figure on the cover. For whatever reason, I didn't get it. Fast forward to now, the DVD has, in fact, gone out of print. And it will cost you an arm and a leg. I'm looking at eBay right here, and it looks like some of the some of the UK editions are a little bit cheaper at like $75 to $80. If you want American edition, it will cost you about, looks like $95 is the cheapest here. So don't do that. Do not buy that. It's not worth the $95. And the VHS is a little bit cheaper. I think you can find it for like $40 or $50. So if you VHS that, that's actually not bad for a very, very rare horror film. And there is no Blu-ray release of this film. So how did you watch it, Pat? Well, I watched it by illegal means. I wouldn't normally do that. I wouldn't normally suggest that someone does that. But when a film is out of print and it will cost you part of your mortgage to get it to even watch it, I don't have a problem with that. So I watched it by secret illegal means. Cough, cough, YouTube has an entire entire film on there. So I can't really review the quality of like the look of the film, so I'm just going to kind of skip over that. And obviously I won't be talking about any special features because they do not exist on a YouTube rip of it. But yeah, so this was more for my enjoyment, just kind of to, it was for a novelty. So I was just trying to spot the little places where I'd been, and I think I did pinpoint a couple places. But this film, if you didn't have a reason really to watch this film, you might not need to, except if you're a Clive Barker completist, or B, a monster movie nut like me. So this movie, it's good in the sense that most creature features, you don't see the creature until later in the movie. So I'm thinking like Pumpkinhead, you don't really see him full on right away. I'm thinking anything, Leprechaun, you don't see him right away, etc. This film shows him to you about 5 minutes in, when the quote-unquote unwitting farmer accidentally releases said demon. If you've ever seen an episode of Power Rangers, the villains who wear kind of the big suits, that's what he looks like. He also looks like a Godzilla monster villain guy, shrunk down to kind of like a human size, a little bit taller than human size, like 7 feet. I had heard, and I don't know if this is true, but I'd heard the budget kind of got cut towards the end of pre-production. So the suit, they kind of had to stop doing any animatronics. So the mouth opens a tiny bit, but that's it. It doesn't look that bad. The shape of the head almost actually reminds me of Pumpkinhead. It has kind of like a weird long snout almost. The problem is the eyes. And I don't know if maybe originally they were going to try and do some animatronic eyes that kind of like bugged out or blinked even. But as it stands now, the eyes have these ugly looking yellow pupils that glow red every once in a while, seemingly for no reason. And they don't blink ever. And they sort of look like a googly eyes bugging out of the thing's face. So design-wise, that's what kills this movie, is it's very hard to take good old Rex seriously with his eyes, because he constantly looks not only surprised slash shocked, but also kind of just happy, kind of giddy as he's killing people, but not in a creepy way, just in a kind of like, what the hell were they thinking way. If you can get past that, then you're in for some just pure cheesiness gold, because this is literally about an hour of Rawhead Rex going across the countryside killing people. And it's quite gory, and if you're just looking for that sort of film, it's right up your alley. The only problem is the other 30 minutes is quite boring compared to that hour of killing. But I kind of thought on this overnight, and I don't think that's that big of a negative, because what monster film can you think of that gives you that hour of just pure mayhem with just a half an hour of sort of filler? You know, usually it's like all filler and then 15 minutes of hopefully, you know, nice gory rampage from the monster. But no, this is the about 2/3 of this film are the monster causing havoc. And I think that is a very, very good aspect of this film, because I can't think of any other monster movies like that. And like I said, if you can picture a Power Rangers villain just mercilessly killing innocent Irish countrysiders, then this film is going to be right up your alley. It definitely goes off the rails at the end scene. I don't want to give anything away, but it's definitely something you have to see for yourself, because this is sort of pre-CGI. And this movie is, it has a grand scope, we'll put it that way, because they try to do some sort of CGI stuff. And I'm thinking, you know those sort of like the lightning effects that were kind of rampant in 80s horror films? So it happens in, I can't even think of an example, it happens in Poltergeist. There's a lot of these like sort of lightning things where they sort of, I think they kind of painted over the cells of the film. There's another similar effect in Nightmare on Elm Street where Freddy dies at the end. I mean, plot spoiler, if you haven't seen it, that's really your own problem. Freddy kind of falls and turns into this like lightning-looking mist for a second. So I don't know what the actual term for that is, but it happens a lot in 80s films. And it's a little bit cheesy, but used correctly, I think it's fine. But this film abuses it to the max. So about the last 5 to 10 minutes of this film are all that effect all over the screen, and it almost makes it impossible to see what's going on, because everything else behind the fake lightning and laser show is lost. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But overall, this is a movie that you have to watch with an open mind, and you have to really know what you're getting into before you watch it, because it is a creature feature. It does have a googly monster eyes, googly eyed monster, say that 5 times fast, who's always looking surprised, shocked, and giddy as he kills people. But it's not a good movie. I'll just, screenplay by Barker be damned, it's not a good movie, but it's definitely a prime example of so bad it's so good. And, you know, the Irish countryside, the setting of it is really, really pretty. It was cool to see some spots that I had driven by. And the monster, like I said, if you're a monster movie completist or freak, you will really, really enjoy this. Just know it's not a good film. It goes in these so bad, it's so good camp. So throw it on if you get some people over by illegal means, YouTube, cough, cough, and see what you think. I hope this does get a Blu-ray release, because I think, if the quality was cleaned up a little bit, Although you just see the monster even more, which is kind of funny because they'd probably brighten it up and you'd notice all the flaws. But I don't know. I would love to see a Blu-ray of this. I'd love to see some special features, some commentary tracks, etc. But until then, we're left with sort of either A, this YouTube or a torrent or also the VHS. But if you don't want to try any of those options, your best bet is to go on eBay and spend a couple $100 or sell your first newborn child, maybe sacrifice him or her to Rawhead Rex themselves. But that's it for this week. I'm going to give this movie like a B+, all things considered. It was really, really fun. We'll just leave it at that. So that's it for this week's review. I just want to peddle some books on you real quick, if you don't mind. As I always mention in the beginning of the segment, I am a horror author, and so I do have my second novel coming out in about 2 weeks as of this recording. So April 15th, it releases through Sinister Grin Press, and that is called We Came Back. It's sort of a otherworldly meets our world possible teenage cult thing going on, and it does in fact have monsters, go figure. So if you like some of the films I do review, I think you'll also like the book. I don't think I've announced this on the show yet, but I am donating all of my royalties to a cancer related fund, like a charity. So if that at all perked your ears up and you don't want to put money in my pocket but wanted to go to a good cause and want to read some hopefully good horror in the meantime, like I said, that is We Came Back, releasing through Sinister Grin Press on April 15th. I'm sure I will be sort of pimping that in future episodes as well. But thanks so much for hearing my pitch on that. And always, if you have a suggestion for a slightly lesser known or obscure film, hit the guys up on the Facebook group or shoot them an email at darkdiscussions@aol.com. If I haven't seen the film, or possibly even if I have, add it to the ever-growing list of future reviews. And that's all I got. So we'll see you next week. And as always, thanks so much for listening. Take care.
So let's see. Any news? Anybody have news?
Nope.
No? Okay. We do have a couple of emails. So let me read those emails out. One is from our friend Deanna of New Jersey. She has written in the past, and she has written once again. This was about a week and a half ago. And all right, and this is what she has to say. She goes, "Hello, everyone. I'm in the middle of listening to your show on Chopping Mall and just wanted to email you to tell you again how much I love the show. Mike and Eric mentioned their cats at the top of the show, and I always like to hear about people's pets, even if they mess up the podcast. I just had to put my last remaining cat down, and hearing about yours made me smile." Yeah, that's too bad. Hopefully she'll get a new companion. "Keep up the good work, and keep us posted on the calendar for 2018. I'm still looking forward to it, and plan on buying a few. I'm going to go back to the podcast now. Deanna of New Jersey." So thank you, Deanna, for that email.
Yeah, thank you.
And then we do have an email from one of our listeners, Shauna Jordan, and this is what she has to say. "Hi, guys and gal. As you may know, I have been a long-time listener and have always enjoyed hearing your different takes and insight into the horror genre. When the film Get Out premiered, I was very much interested in how people of different races would receive the film, and what, if any, takeaways they would have. I was a little worried going into a couple of my favorite podcasts that do not have any persons of color on the panel because, as you all mentioned, it can be difficult to navigate topics surrounding race relations, especially when you cannot fully relate to, quote-unquote, the black experience. I definitely do not want to hijack your podcast and take it away from its usual subject matter, but I did want to just briefly address some of what was said during the discussion on appropriation. I think it is wrong to view appropriation as people getting angry anytime someone not of a specific culture attempts to enjoy something that originated within that culture. Appropriation for me, and what I think Get Out, the movie, was trying to highlight, is the co-opting of something from someone without appreciation and respect. Get Out takes this to an extreme, the taking of one's body, but in real life, it doesn't look like that. I would never get angry at someone wearing their hair in Conroe-style braids, as Kylie Jenner did about a year ago, where there was a thing in the news about that. What will make me angry is if, say, Kim Kardashian wearing her hair in a cornrow-style braids and Elle magazine reporting how she's starting a new trend of boxer braids and how epic they are. It's not that she's wearing her hair in a style that originated in African culture. It's her wearing the style and then society crediting it as something she's originated, complete with a new name. To further explain, it's not that she's wearing the style, it's that black people have worn it for hundreds of years and have faced bans on the style at school and in the workplace and have been told that it's unprofessional and that we look unkempt. But when she wears it, it's a chic new style for all, and here's a tutorial for how you, too, can get boxer braids. This is something that happens to non-white cultures and ethnicities all the time. It happens so much that it can seem that people are just being overly sensitive when they complain, and that unfortunately contributes to a misunderstanding of what we mean when we say appropriation. It's not that someone may enjoy it, too. It's the complete co-opting of something. To bring this back to horror, I believe Jordan Peele took the subject of appropriation and brought it to the extreme. It perfectly illustrates the fear of erasure of oneself to be used for the enjoyment of another. Anywho, I just had some comments I wanted to add, and I wanted to be brief. I hope I was able to add additional insight. Thanks, Shauna.
Wow, that was a really great email.
It was. Thank you, Sean.
It was.
And that really clarified a lot of stuff for me, too. That was fantastic. Sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say we truly do appreciate the input because we realized we were a little short of insight on that particular episode. So thank you.
Yeah. I think her explanation is perfect and right on because, again, it's not a big deal for anybody to wear their hair, at least in the Kylie Jenner example. They can wear it any way they want. It's when the press and the media and pop culture then takes that and it takes it away. What is it? Co-opting is the word she used. That's the word, mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense. So I think that's where she was coming to. And she explained it quite well. Anybody else want to add anything?
She said it better than I ever could.
All right, very good, very good. So appreciate that, Shauna, and hopefully you'll keep on sending emails. We need emails. Keep on sending emails. I guess we can get into our topic for tonight. Eric, why don't you let everybody know?
All right, tonight we're going to be talking about Kong Skull Island.
These are photos of an island in the South Pacific.
The place where myth and science meet. We
use explosives to shake the earth, helping us to map the surface of the island.
They're dropping bombs.
Scientific instruments.
Is that a monkey?
Magnificent.
You knew that thing was out here?
I'm sorry for your man, Colonel. But if you want to make this sacrifice worthwhile, get us home. With proof. Monsters exist.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
Your friend there can put that down. What the hell is this place?
That's Kong. He's king around here.
Kong's pretty good king. Keeps to himself mostly.
Well, you don't go into someone's house and start dropping bombs unless you're picking a fight.
Kong's god on the island, but the devils live below us.
And what are they called?
I call them skull crawlers.
Why?
Never said that name out loud before. It sounds stupid now that I say it. Just you call them whatever you want.
Thank you.
a good group of boys.
We're all gonna die together out here. He shouldn't have come here.
That's right. Kong Skull Island is the latest big blockbuster genre picture from the studio system. As people will probably gather, it is about King Kong. It was originally just going to be called Skull Island, but they changed the name and added Kong to it to get name recognition. The film is oddly directed by someone of not much note. It's a guy named Jordan Voight Roberts, who had only done, if I'm not mistaken, one other, I guess, motion picture. Mostly otherwise he's done TVs and stuff. I guess the main thing is probably who stars in the film, because there's some big names in the film, and obviously the first one would be Tom Hiddleston. I think that's one of your favorite actors, Chrissy?
No, I do. I like him very much. I think he's really good. I think I first became aware of him in Thor, and I always just really liked him. I thought he was a good actor, and I'm glad to see him getting a little more attention. You know, I think down the road he can do. I mean, he was in Crimson Peak too. I think he's done great work, especially in the genre, and I'm looking forward to, if he hasn't already, and I don't know about it, breaking out and doing some non-genre work and seeing how far he can really push himself. So,
right. Yeah, because he's done the superhero films as well, playing Loki in the Marvel series. Let me discuss the screenwriters, because I didn't really do that correctly. Dan Gilroy is listed as the top screenwriter, and he's the guy that wrote and directed Nightcrawler. And then Max Bernstein is another guy, and he's been involved in the Godzilla film and the Minority Report. Derek Connolly is a fourth screenwriter. He did Jurassic World and Monster Trucks. And then the story was written by a guy named John Gaddins. And John Gaddins is known probably most for Flight with Denzel Washington and Real Steel from a couple of years ago. And then the other actors of note in this film is Brie Larson, who won an Academy Award last year for The Room. This is probably her big breakout film for mainstream Hollywood. Samuel L. Jackson, Sean C. Reilly, and then John Goodman are all the big names. Shea Whigham is another face that everybody knows from genre, from Splinter and Take Shelter. And that's pretty much the only folks I knew. Anybody else wanted to add any details?
Not really.
All right, fair enough. All right, so let's go around and decide, see what people thought and where they heard about this film. I actually heard about this film when we did our 2017 preview, because I didn't know anything about it, and I don't even think I had seen a trailer or heard about it until, I believe, it was you, Abe, that brought it up. So I was fairly unfamiliar with it until the beginning of the year in January. And then my opinion of the film was that it was pretty damn good. The first 50 minutes I thought was a little bit weak, and there's some characters that are caricatures, but all in all, especially the last hour and 10 minutes of the film is really great. The main thing is we're going into this film looking for monster madness, and it has a lot of that. And though some of the big actors you could tell were going to be redshirted, it still was debatable who was going to make it and who wasn't. And all in all, well done, excellent special effects, and specifically the three great character actors, Samuel L. Jackson, John Goodman, and John C. Reilly, I think were the highlights of the film, and outshined our two leads, Hiddleston and Larson, by far. Eric?
I have a lot of the same sentiments. Anytime monsters were on the screen in this movie, I was having a blast. I thought the people were much, much, much less interesting. I don't think a lot of the big names in this movie were needed because their characters were kind of pointless. John Goodman was wasted. Brie Larson was wasted. There's really no reason for Tom Hiddleston to be there. Early John C. Reilly and Samuel L. Jackson were the only ones that had any character of weight. And I had some issues with Samuel L. Jackson's character as well. So didn't really like the people in this movie, but man, were the monsters fun. So if you're looking for monster action, go see the movie. Just try and grit your teeth through the first 15 minutes that Phil was referring to before the action starts.
All right, Mike, I think you just joined us. What was your opinion of this film, and how did you first hear about it?
I first heard about it because there was like a multi-million-dollar marketing campaign. I don't know. I don't remember where it was I first heard about it. I just knew it was being made at some point. I like the movie. I don't have quite the same problems with the characters. I think you're right. There's not much done with them. I think, though, they had good character actors in a lot of it, and I think the actors can carry some of the weight that the script doesn't. But I think I said this with the My Godzilla review. We don't watch it for the people. I mean, maybe somebody went to see it for Tom Hiddleston. I wasn't one of them.
One of my friends at work only went to see it for Tom Hiddleston.
Well, then she gets
she
what she deserves.
She told me so. She is the one person in the world who did that.
All right, and I have no sympathies. And I had, like, look, I mean, John Goodman is my second favorite giant ape, so I was happy to see him there. And I agree that more could have been done, but I think for the role he had, if you had a lesser actor in it, or a less charismatic actor, maybe a less hammy actor, then what little was there would have completely sunk beneath the waves. You know, and you could say the same about, I think, Sam Jackson, and for that matter, Brie Larson and Tom Hiddleston. But, well, I mean, I can't remember the actor's name right now. The one who played Cole, I really liked a lot, and I thought he brought a lot to the character, although, again, not much of an arc to the character. And I was very happy that John C. Reilly, I really did not like the one line in the film that they showed in, like, every trailer about the skull crawlers.
Right.
And I thought it was a really bad joke, and it was an attempt to do, like, a Joss Whedon thing without doing it well.
Right.
Although he's made mistakes with that, too, like the Toad line from X-Men.
God, was that his fault?
Well, that was his line. He didn't think it was delivered the way he had written it, but because it was too self-serious when it was written, but when it was performed.
But Kong.
But I think otherwise he was really good, and the audience applauded for his character at the end of the film. But yeah, I mean, you're going to see this because you want to watch frickin' monsters. And you want to see King Kong fight frickin' monsters. It took Godzilla to a second film to realize they want to see monsters fight other monsters. Kong got that right out of the gate. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. And it is a damn beautiful film to look at. I think you could say that about both Kong and Godzilla, is that they are probably two of the prettiest monster movies ever made.
All right, very good. We'll keep Abe for last, because this is an Abe film, and he's going to give his spiel. So we'll go with you, Chrissy.
We saw it on a Saturday night of opening weekend, and the place was packed. People had such a blast that the whole theater clapped and cheered at the end, which was awesome just to experience that in a packed house. I also thought it was cool that the audience, nobody got up when it was over. Everybody sat through the credits. Everybody stayed through to the end. I really had a blast with this movie. Excuse me. I thought it was totally monster porn at its finest. This had come out when I was about 10. I'd have been creaming myself. I went there to see monsters, and there was
I'm going to need a minute.
Okay. Let you get that image out of your head that you really didn't need, right? there was monsters every 10 to 15 minutes, and I just really enjoyed that. I, in general, was happy with the way that it totally honored the tropes of this particular monster genre. It was great to see the ridiculously heavy-handed anti-war message. It was great to see that the man cannot be God message was so browbeaten into the script. It was really fun to see little callbacks to other famous films like Them. There was a reference to Jurassic Park 3 in there. There was like some really interesting stuff. The whole hollow world theory, the hollow earth theory, that was really classic in a lot of those earlier films, like Journey to the Center of the Earth. I'll talk more about that later. I didn't really necessarily care about who was in it or who wasn't. Like I said, that kind of wasn't what I was looking for. So I had a good time with the monsters, and I really appreciated the very classic style romance that was structured in exactly the same way that all the romances are structured in the films of the 50s and 60s. Somebody was paying attention here. I watched The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms the other day, and I was like, oh my God, well, they ripped the whole romance pattern right out of this. Really pretty cool. So there were some things there I had some fun with. But I've been telling people, you know, who are asking me what I think and should they go see it. My reaction is, if you're a monster freak and you were when you were a kid, then you'll love this. If you're expecting high art, you know, deep messaging, fabulous acting, and anything that just isn't about monsters and blowing stuff up, then don't go there. Stay home or go, I don't know, go rent something else. So, or go see The Shack or something. I don't know. But that's what I'm saying. As a monster movie, I had a ball. And, you know, as anything more than a monster movie, I really don't. I just think you should just go enjoy it for the monsters.
All right, Abe.
Yeah, so I hung up with this film way before it was released this year. And, you know, I was really excited for it because, well, giant monsters. I love kaiju films. It was one of the things I grew up on when I was younger. The Godzilla films really were influenced my love for the film in general, alongside the Barry Harryhausen films and some horror flicks. And I've seen the original King Kong. I've seen the 2005 version. I've seen the 1970 version. I've seen some of the Japan's take on Kong. So I've, you know, Kong's been, you know, I've been very familiar with the character. So it's really cool to finally see him being taken on and his new kind of approach. I love the visuals, first of all. Yeah, I have to echo what's said about how great the film looks, because it looks fantastic. It's got a very great sense of, spectacle. Everything is titanic, huge. You feel how puny the human characters are in the face of these creatures. And the pacing is great, too. I mean, the first part isn't too bad, in my opinion, because we get to the island much quicker than we did to the creatures of the Godzilla from, I think it was 2014 or something like that.
That's a fair point.
You know, we got there much quicker than we can, and we didn't have to wait so goddamn long for Kong to make his appearance than we did for Godzilla. Kong was actually the star of his film and not just a little side piece that popped up once in a while. And because of that, I finally got, not only did you get to see Kong doing some cool stuff, but we got a sense of character from him. There's a lot more personality. I got a better understanding of the creature. And he's a nice, cool mix mash of all the Kongs beforehand. You know, you got some of the classic behaviors of the original. You got some of the kind of humanoid form that the Toho did. And so it's really cool to see him come together, become this really badass Kong. The other creatures are fantastic, too. And, you know, they act as great co-stars. And whenever any creature shows up, it's really fantastic. The human characters, yeah, we don't really go to see the film to for them, and most of them were really undercooked. That being said, I really felt that they at least had some kind of sense of a sense of presence than our characters from the Godzilla film. The reason I can bring the Godzilla film so many times is because, well, this is the same universe. We'll talk about that at some point. But I feel that the approach was just handled better for the Kong film. And yes, if you're going to see a film for giant monsters, this is a film for you. You're not going to find great characters. Some things are a little heavy-handed in terms of themes. But the pacing, the action, and the payoff, like whenever a creature shows up or some action sequence comes in, it's awesome. And yeah, this was a great film, and I can't wait to dig into this.
All right, very good. So, I think everything more that you said, Eric, summed it up for me as well. And I would give it a 3 out of 4 stars, all in all, because I did have some interest in, or wanted to have some interest in the characters besides the monster. And unfortunately, they had some issues. And as Chrissy said, they were stereotypes or anti this or whatever at points as well. So, but all in all, yep, really good film, and will probably make my top 20. I assume it'll be considered one of our two lists, whether we consider it horror or other genre. I'm going to drop off now. So, Eric, you got to take over. Make sure everybody is in line.
Uh-oh, pressure's on.
Yeah, and I got to get back to work. And unfortunately, I wanted to talk about a lot of those things, but alas, it is not going to happen. So, Eric, just
being an adult sucks, doesn't it?
It sure does at times.
Well, I do have a real question, though.
Yes.
On occasion, Skype craps out.
Eric will text me.
Okay.
Yeah, so when you guys are about to wrap it up, Eric will text me, and then I'll come in and give my final thoughts. Or if Skype goes down, he'll text me. So,
yep.
The burdens of working at home.
Indeed. I'm not dropping off of Skype either, so I'll still have the microphone on the side for quick access. So, all right, guys.
All right. Thanks.
All right. See ya.
See you later, Phil.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye.
Okay.
All right.
So. All right. So. So now that Phil's gone, tonight's real topic, top 10 ways to chop asparagus.
Or
no snapping.
The virtues of Colin Kaepernick. There we go. Anyway, I'm going to read the wiki for Kong Skull Island as found on IMDb right here. Pretty straightforward. A team of scientists explore. What?
What are you doing?
I'm reading the wiki. Wiki.
Thank you.
A team of you get really upset when I don't do that. A team of scientists explore an uncharted island in the Pacific, venturing into the domain of the mighty Kong, and must fight to escape a primal Eden. That is a little weird.
A primal?
Why
what?
Would you a primal Eden? Eden isn't somewhere you'd want to escape. But anyway, whatever.
Well, you didn't see the thing about giant bamboo spiders in the Genesis?
Well, yeah, but I wouldn't describe that as Eden. That's my point.
I think what they were trying to do was cleverly say that it was unspoiled, an unspoiled place. But you're right. That is a bizarre comparison. That's bizarre. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So, basically... we start out our movie rounding up all of our characters, and the short version is Samuel L. Jackson is the head of a military unit who's leaving Vietnam. They are all sorts of emotionally distraught at the fact that they are being pulled out of Vietnam. In the meantime, John Goodman is the head of a project that's been laughed at for a long time. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. Mike, you got
Monarch.
It? Abe,
Monarch, which was the same organization as in the Godzilla film.
Yes, no question.
And in fact, he even uses the phrase massive
unidentified, the Bantus,
terrifying object or something
massive,
like that.
It's massive unidentified organism, I think. Massive unidentified organism or something, yeah.
Anyway, the same acronym they used in the Godzilla movie. So he's leading Monarch, and he's been laughed at for years because he thinks monsters are real. Turns out he's right. And Brie Larson is a photographer who goes along for very, really just paper thin reasons.
She's a war correspondent.
Right.
She's up for a Pulitzer Prize. And they're going off to
an island in the middle of nowhere.
She's obviously I'm going to take pictures of pretty places sort of, like, you know, the Taj Mahal sort of photographer. Or smiling babies. She's right. An action kind of person, and you're going to one of the last unidentified places on the planet. She's like sort of that action photographer, reporter sort of thing. Remember, she's a war correspondent, and the war has literally just ended the moment we start the film.
Yes.
Or the come back from the credit sequence, rather, because there is a...
Yeah, I did want to give a little bit of history about that, so when you guys are ready, I'll fill you in.
Let me finish rounding up the characters, and then I'll let you go at it. And then we have Tom Hiddleston, who is former MI6, I think?
He's British Secret Service or something.
He's supposed to be the best tracker in the world, basically, and they hire him to have him help guide the troops through the island. And John C. Reilly plays a pilot who actually crashed on the island during World War II and has been living there with the natives ever since, and makes a surprise appearance to our group of characters once they get there. So that's pretty much all. Oh, and there's also a character played by Tian Jing, and I'm still unclear as to what her purpose was.
I know.
Okay.
I know.
Go for it.
She was a token Chinese person, so they could either get money from China or investment from China.
You're probably right.
Or to be able to open, because China doesn't let every movie open there. So okay. You put a token Chinese person in there, no offense to the actress,
yay.
And they're like, you know, you want to open, we better see some Chinese faces in with the round eyes.
Right.
And that's why it wasn't a Japanese scientist, it wasn't a Korean scientist.
Yeah,
we need somebody who looks Asian and doesn't say anything. That's
pretty much the purpose she fulfilled. Yes. I'll try and stop bitching about the characters for a second, and I will turn it over to Christy to say what she wanted to about the history.
Oh yeah, this opens. You know, once we're done with the credit sequence, we see that it is 1973, and specifically, it was probably January 23rd. 1973, because that is the day that Nixon, his national security advisor was Henry Kissinger, and Kissinger had managed to negotiate, finally, to get us out of Vietnam. And so what happened was, on January 23rd, 1973, something called the Paris Peace Accords was put into effect. And what that was basically a piece, just kind of a rough, loose, like there's a lot of pieces to it, but I'm just going to say this just to be clear and quick, that for 60 days, there was basically a peace established so that all of the Americans could pull out of Vietnam. So they had 60 days to literally get out, which was why everything was moving so quickly at the beginning of the film, where you see Nixon announcing it on TV. And yes, that is, I do believe that is a real clip of the real footage when he was on television announcing it. But that's why it was moving so quickly. That's why everybody's like, okay, we got to pack up, we got to get out, because they did not have, I mean, we all think, oh, 60 days, not a big deal. You know, that's a long time, but really it's kind of not. They wanted to have everybody out of there.
Not an army, no.
Yeah, I was going to say, not possible. When you're dealing with that amount of equipment.
Exactly. So it wasn't a lot of time. So just in case anybody did not know the background of that, I just wanted to throw that in there. And I really thought that was actually smart. I thought that was a smart choice on the part of the storytellers or the writers, because it gave it a sense of urgency, which it didn't normally need to have. You know, they could have just said, oh, we're in Vietnam, we're going to pick the best fighter pilots and let's go. And it wouldn't have had that same sense of, you know, like I said, urgency.
It was pretty much a signal the world was changing quickly.
Right.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would agree with that. Well, and it ties in with... Go ahead, Mike.
What I think is interesting is that if you made this movie, not that they could have, but if they tried to make this movie 40 years ago, if you made a movie about the set during the Vietnam War in the 1970s, that movie would have been about the Vietnam War. When you make a movie about the Vietnam War now, you're making a movie about not the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War is basically a metaphor, right? It's not going to be quite as literal or on the nose. You know, they use it to discuss sort of other things that they're talking about. And so it's just sort of an interesting... I mean, they're talking more broad stuff that applies to, you could argue, war in general. Although, you know, notice that the nominal hero of the film is the veteran from the last good war. But even he, you know, has that moment of how he has that line about how he... You know, once we got the war out of the way and we learned to be just friends, you know, it's just sort of, okay.
Yeah, a little on the nose, but...
Just a touch.
Yeah, I do, though, about the whole on the nose thing, which was kind of interesting. I don't use Wikipedia for anything as a resource. I just don't. I will often use it to give me an idea as to other places to look for things or, you know, if they've got sources cited, I might go check out those sources. But today, just for the hell of it, because I was trying to compile some notes, I was like, let me just go what they say about monster movie. Just for the hell of it. I don't even know why I thought to look on Wikipedia for that. So I did, and they had a really interesting definition. And it was honestly, I could not have written this better myself, because for me, this sums up just about every classic monster movie I've seen. A monster movie, creature feature, or giant monster film is a disaster film where innocent civilians and emergency services struggling to stay alive in assaults against animals, often abnormally large ones, or other types of monsters. The monster is usually created by a folly of mankind, an experiment gone wrong, the effects of radiation, or the destruction of habitat. Usually, the monster is from outer space, has been on Earth for a very long time with no one ever seeing it, or has been released / awakened from a prison of some sort where it was being held. I think that's probably the most accurate definition of a monster movie that I have ever heard. It pretty much nails it. Every trope is in there.
Okay.
But that was my point about Kong, is that the message was heavy-handed. I expected it to be, because it's part of it. I mean, we get it in Them. We get it in Creature from the Black Lagoon, has the whole habitat message. There's always a message. I mean, you guys have seen probably more of these than I have, so.
Right, and, well, I mean, as a message film, it's heavy-handed, but it's not exactly cutting-edge, right? I mean,
no, it's not. It's the same old shit.
Yeah, it's basically, well, and war is bad.
And it's okay, because it's a monster movie.
Right.
And we're not here for the message.
Right. It's not like they're going to use a monster movie as a metaphor for, you know, crippling bureaucracy.
It could be done.
It was done, but yeah. but, you know, it's not as easy to sell, and it's certainly not as easy to write. So we have people go someplace where they don't know what they're doing, and it blows up in their face.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, you know, that does talk about a whole lot of different human ventures, not necessarily just war, because it really isn't so much...
Well,
because really you could argue it's not specifically war that it's against, because let's be honest, this is a violent film. It seems to enjoy its violence.
Right.
It's more about maybe being a little bit more humble in where you go and where you step. But there are other things, like obviously like Sam Jackson's character... You know,
I want to talk about him.
Let's talk after we
throw up the spoiler flag. We've all given our opinions. We've kind of danced around the edges of the message and the plot and everything. Do you want to throw up the spoiler flag at this point?
Spoiler!
All right.
Spoiler, spoiler, spoiler. I want to talk about the giant stick bug.
All right. Well, first, let's Mike was mentioning Sam Jackson's character. I mentioned that he kind of bugged me. And here's the reason why. There's one particular thing, and you guys have been doing this with me for a while, so you know I can fixate on something small, and that's what's going on here, and I know it.
But, is it the fact that Sam Jackson doesn't look like he's aged in the last 30 years?
No.
Oh, okay.
It is the fact that he's a military man, right?
He's a colonel.
He's a colonel. So he's been doing this war thing for a while. And here's the thing, is that eventually we get to a point where we're in spoiler territory, FYI.
Yep.
Where we realize there are other monsters on this island, and Kong is kind of worshipped by the natives because he kills the other monsters on the island and ultimately protects the natives. When they first come to the island, they're dropping essentially bombs, their seismic devices to measure the land. And he goes into defense mode and takes out the helicopters because essentially they're attacking his home. That's an understandable reaction, right? If somebody's attacking your home, you defend it. And then later in the movie, Samuel Jackson is upset that Kong killed a bunch of his men. Again, understandable. But he gets fixated on going after Kong and killing Kong. And they try and explain this to him about how Kong is actually protecting them. And he doesn't want to hear about it. And my whole thing is, if Samuel Jackson's been in the military for quite some time, as it appears, he's probably read The Art of War. Of which one of the most famous quotes is, "The enemy of my enemy is my friend." And you'd think that of all people in the world, his character in this movie would understand that concept and be like, yeah, you know what? You're right. Let's forget the monkey and get the fuck off the island. And that was my big issue with his character.
Well, I think we have a problem here in that the characters are split up into three groups. And one group goes off and gets killed. One group goes off and beats the villagers, and they get the whole backstory of the island.
Mm-hmm.
And Kong's role in the ecosystem and all that. And the other group is just having shit coming out of everywhere and killing them and trying to kill them. And that happens to be the Sam Jackson group. So he doesn't have quite the information either. But I think it's clear that he is the guy who's like, he has the classic line that we didn't lose the war. We abandoned it.
Yeah.
Right. And there is, we don't want to get into that. I think there's some merit to that, and you can argue it both ways. But that's certainly a lot of people have that point of view. So
yeah, was it
angry, I think a video game?
Oh.
Yeah, so he's angry over this, and again, this is why it's important that the war just ended, that he's pulling out, and that there are that all of this, he says, this work and sacrifice has been for naught because they're just abandoning it. And again, well, you're not free with it, but that's so there are people with that particular mindset. That's his character's mindset. So now he's in the position where now they've done this. He's not abandoning other men, and he's sure as hell not. He's got to complete a mission. And so, in his mind, that mission is going to be get the motherfucker who killed his men.
Well, and I'm That's saying he chose poorly.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, one thing I noticed was that he really did not. He seems to live for the mission because he was really quick to take the offer for the small one last ride. Some of the other characters see me walking around with scars. They're not really explored enough, but one character played by Shea Whigham, who plays Cole.
Right, that's his name. Thank you.
Yeah, who displays a lot of signs of PTSD in terms of like staring off or being very, well, just broken in a sense there. And so, you know, I have no doubt that perhaps Samuel Jackson's characters carry some of that. And, you know, the idea of maybe what I got from his desire to kill Kong, not just pure insanity, but because he already abandoned one, had one war abandoned. He wanted to abandon this one. He wanted to see it finished, even if he felt like he was on the wrong side of it.
Yeah. No, I get all that. I just thought it was, I don't know. The fact that he wouldn't even stop to absorb the information that the people who had been in the village were giving him irked me.
Well, there is
somebody who's a strategic military leader would be able to do that. That's all.
Well, one, I find that there is certainly a tendency for certain people who write films to think that that's the mindset of anybody who is a military leader.
Well, okay, that's a fair point.
And I'm not going to say that's necessarily unfair or justified, whatever. That's a whole argument for another day. Yeah. He fits into a trope. And Kong has always had a echoes of Hearts of Darkness and Apocalypse Now. We've joked about this being marketed as Apocalypse Kong. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's sort of this, Colonel Kurtz character, this guy who's gotten obsessed and kind of lost it going upriver. Now, it happens really frickin' fast.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, that scene, it was a kind of a traumatic experience he went through, so I'm willing to chalk it up to PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta be honest, I just love that there's that shot of him, and it's the sort of, not a lot of actors can pull it off the way Sam Jackson can. There's just that shot of him at the end of his little battle with Kong, of him like bathed in red light and fire, and you know, just the pure, you know, Sam Jackson-ness in that look.
Right.
It's a great shot.
And I truly believe that his character actually is not afraid of Kong.
Oh, no, God, no.
Well, and I thought that thing at the end, too, it was interesting. First of all, I know we're jumping way ahead, but Nathan and I both thought that after having spent this whole movie with him raging against Kong and raging against Kong, his death was so anticlimactic.
Oh,
it was just like, see, smash and it's gone. Like, okay.
That was one of the 2 points in the movie where I laughed out loud, and people around me...
Yeah, I think my husband did, too.
People around me did not think it was funny.
Husband said it was like Deep Blue Sea, sort of.
Yeah, the other one was later. The other one was later with the grenades. We'll get to that later.
So, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I mean, yeah, it was certainly one of them... Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of moments where these big deaths for certain major characters were supposed to be shocking in a way, but some of the way they were handled were kind of like, I guess, in one way, were kind of played for the. They felt to me they were played for the cheese, and other times they were to subvert expectations of certain events, like Cole's attempted sacrifice.
I think, again, part of it, if this is all about sort of that futility of war sort of thing, and again, Jax's frustration at the sacrifice of his men's lives being completely in vain, well, it just keeps reinforcing that with the way that Sam Jackson goes out and the way the other character goes out later and, you know, the way the guy with the birds goes out. It's that these are all pointless deaths, completely pointless. They didn't have to happen, and they're all just going badly. You know, there, you don't get that heroic sacrifice in it. And I think that itself is a comment. You don't have an Obi-Wan Kenobi moment.
Right. That's true. You know, I never thought of it that way, but you're right. That is, could very well be part of that anti-war trope, you know, that kind of runs through all of it. Because Jackson hams it up, too, with the whole Icarus story. I mean, that was, like, painfully
fair,
obvious.
Fair.
And it's like really obvious. He's like, you know, they're flying into this this, you know, this storm, I think, right? Wasn't it there? And he's like, an Icarus flew to, and I was like, oh my God, really? Would you be talking about this if you were, maybe, I don't know.
If I've learned anything in watching films, it's never speak aloud the Icarus metaphor, because you're going to die really soon afterwards.
Yeah.
Well, and let's consult with our local scientist here, Mike. What is the theoretical possibility of a storm remaining in place around an island permanently?
What is the theoretical possibility of there being an 80-foot-tall gorilla living in underneath an island in the middle of the Pacific? I mean, what is the theoretical possibility of a boat that has 5 helicopters on it suddenly having 20 helicopters taking off from it?
Oh, shit, you're right. I totally missed that.
I managed to see the movie twice, and someone pointed that out online. And so I watched it the second time. And, yeah, there's actually a couple of helicopters on the back of the boat that you don't see, except very briefly in one shot. But I counted, I think, it was hard because they were always moving, because, you know, helicopters. I think there were like 13 to 15 helicopters in the air.
Uh-huh.
But you only really saw like 7 on the boat, and I don't know why they would be hiding all the others.
Yeah, weird.
Well, I will say, you know, getting back to like Samuel Jackson's death at the end, and we can talk about all the other monster movie callbacks. I don't know if you guys picked, I just watched The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms the other day, like literally just 2 days ago. And when I saw Kong come out of the fire like that, when Samuel Jackson first thinks he's bombed him and he comes out of the fire, totally reminded me of that last scene where the dinosaur is burning in the roller coaster.
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
It looked just like it. And then when I watched the actual real 20,000 Fathoms, I was like, oh, my God. Like, I think, in all actuality, I think some of the filmmakers and writers had fun with this, because I think there were a lot of callbacks in here. I picked up on 5 or 6, and I'm sure I missed a lot more.
Actually, a few people in the horror community have pointed out that there's a kind of a tribute to Cannibal Holocaust in this movie, which I was able to pick up on.
Oh, really? Where?
Even though
I have not actually seen
Cannibal Holocaust.
Yes, okay. So there's a scene of the long legs, the giant spider.
That was Christy's favorite. Let her talk about the sex monsters.
What? No. What were you going to say, Abe?
Okay, so Jackson's crew is walking. So for our listeners, Jackson's crew is walking through the forest with his crew, and one guy falls behind, and suddenly we hear a chunk sound. The guys turn around, and the poor bastard's impaled through the mouth by what looks like a giant, oversized piece of bamboo. And it turns out to be attached to a fuck-off giant spider that begins to attack the group. And basically, there's a famous scene, the Cannibal Holocaust, in which a native woman is impaled through the mouth and ass by a giant stake. So that was literally a callback to some of the jungle horror films.
Definitely. I just wanted to say I loved the stick bug. I have no other comments about the stick bug, except I have never seen a giant stick bug, and that was the coolest thing ever.
Wait. You're talking about the stick bug. You're talking about the one that the guy was sitting on.
He's talking about
right?
the spider. Yeah.
Right.
Abe's talking about the spider. I was talking about the stick bug.
Ah, okay.
That was totally different.
The log monster.
The log monster, it got up and I went, I actually had popcorn in my hand and I was putting it in my mouth, and I was so amazed that literally all the popcorn fell out of my mouth. I was like, oh my God, it's a stick bug. And Nathan's like, quiet. Oh my God, shut up.
You said that out loud.
I
was that excited to see a giant stick bug. That's really sad. I don't know what that says.
That's so hot.
Oh, God.
Stick me, baby. Want to be my stick bug tonight? I'm lonely.
All right, moving on. Okay. No, but seriously, the monsters in this movie, they're the reason to go see the movie. They're pretty freaking strict. The stick monster, the spider, the skull crawlers, I guess that's their name. Even though John C. Reilly's right, that's a really stupid name. And of course, Kong himself. Abe was talking about how the Kong was a different mishmash of different Kongs. And he's right. Personally, even though I understand people have issues with the 2005 King Kong, I kind of like that Kong the best just because the movement is really gorilla-like, and I thought that was pretty cool. But this Kong is awesome in its own way. A lot of chest pounding, that's pretty cool. And I particularly like the helicopter scene when you first encounter Kong, where he's taking out all the helicopters, and there was one shot in particular that I really enjoyed. It's when he goes to swat one of the helicopters, and his hand gets cut on a rotor, and the expression on Kong's face of pain and shock when something actually hurts him was pretty fucking cool.
Well, I don't want to take anything away from Christy, but hands are a big image in this whole film, and thematically, right? It's a linking theme.
Yeah.
So, like, you have in the beginning of the movie when John C. Reilly lands with the Japanese sailor, pilot, and they fight, where the pilot tries to kill him with a sword, and he grabs the sword.
Oh, yeah, ow.
And the blade cuts his hands. Well, what happens to Kong, right? Same thing, he grabs the helicopter, cuts his hand. So this is that, we're starting out as enemies.
John Goodman as well.
But why can't we be friends? Right, and John Goodman, right, there's that moment, John, where
puts his hand up to the
pitch, yeah. Sam Jackson sees, see, it bleeds, we can kill it. It's like, Sam, that's Predator. Oh, whatever, look, he's got the bloody paw print up on the wall, and you see Sam Jackson kind of do, you know, like hold his hand up, not Sam Jackson, John Goodman hold his hand up over, just to, I don't know, for scale or high five, I don't know what he was doing, his hand against the image of the bloody print. And, you know, which is like a mile away, and it's the same size, you know. So, yeah, that's that whole idea of not just the hands, but the bloody hands is a big theme. You're going to delete all these files. I got my cat. Get off the computer. Thank you. Sorry.
I'm proud of you, Mike. You asserted your authority.
Pain in the ass. So, what I will say is, see, I'm a mixed. I was in the middle of watching the 2005 Kong last night, and it's funny because there is a tremendous amount of talent involved in that film, and they really work their ass off to think of all these things. And I'm just thinking, like, you know, the mechanism for how do you get, if they don't want to go on the other side, because every Kong film, right, they are terrified to go on the other side of the wall, except when they have to leave Ann Darrow out there, then we got to open the wall and run out there and hope nobody kills us while we're tying her out there. So they think of a way to lower her out and not do that. And there's all sorts of stuff. They thought about, like, the ecosystem of the island, and it's packed with so many good things. And it's just they couldn't bear to let any of it go when they really needed to make it a tighter film.
Right.
Yeah. But it's not that what's there is bad. It's just it's so stuffed.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a couple of cheesy things, but for the most part, it all works really well. And I love that Kong because it's a big gorilla, and he do get a lot of personality in it, and he's all battle scarred and beaten. But on the other hand, I'm also someone who grew up with the original Kong and the 76 Kong, and a lesser degree Kong versus Godzilla, because it seemed like PIX here in New York would like show us every fucking Godzilla movie except Kong versus Godzilla. And it's like, what is he going to
do? I had not seen that movie up until a few years ago myself.
Yeah, it's like, no, you're going to watch Godzilla versus the Sea Monster again. It's like, but it sucks. It's just, but you'll watch it. It's, well, because Godzilla's in it for 20 seconds. Yeah, we know. And that's the one we got the rights to. But anyway, so, because Kong isn't a, to me, Kong isn't a gorilla. Kong's a monster. You know, he's not. And so I kind of like that aspect. And now here he's much more bipedal than he was in the 33 film. He's much closer to the 76 film.
And that's kind of the point I was going to lead up to, Mike, is that I think the 2005 Kong was a better giant gorilla.
Right.
But the Kong in Kong Skull Island might be a better monster.
Right. And for the same reason, I should say that I also prefer my Kong being of a more moderate size, because so much of the Kong character is about Kong interacting with people.
Uh-huh.
And when you're a gnat, it's hard to think that Kong is really turned on by the blonde gnat. I mean, it was hard enough understanding they was turned on by, you know, the brown mouse, but at least that's a little more reasonable. But obviously, this isn't a Kong for people interaction. This is a Kong for kicking monster ass, so I'm perfectly fine with them, you know, hitting him up with steroids.
Well, and yeah, I got to say that one of the main purposes of this movie is to get us ready for a big-ass motherfucking Kong to fight Godzilla. Because they clearly tell you that's what's coming next at the end of this movie.
Yeah. The Kong here is only a teenager.
Yeah, they say he's only a teenager. He's a lot of growing.
Yeah, so he ain't done growing. He's going to get a lot bigger. And so I have a feeling next time we see him, he's going to be Godzilla size, and that could be fun.
I did read, I got the art book for Kong. Because monster movies especially, I'll try to grab the art books. And in the book, they do mention, like, they did decide that he's not a gorilla, he's a monster. He's not going to be the same species, a spigger. They wanted deliberately to make him something different. And I did read the book, it did confirm something that I liked, which was the skull crawlers. Like, the skull crawlers, I was a little iffy about. It's funny how, like, one little thing can change your opinion on something. And it did for me here. And I'm not saying it's a valid reason. I'm not saying it's a good reason. If he said it's a completely bullshit reason, I'll go, okay, fine. But I wasn't that thrilled with the skull crawler design. I definitely don't like the name, because that one line in the film is terrible.
Yeah.
But if you go back to the original 33 Kong, right, you have the famous log scene guys cross the sea. Well, in the original, Jack Driscoll jumps off the cliff and hides in a hole in the cliff, and Kong is reaching in trying to grab him. And as this is going on, there's a lizard that crawls up the cliff from the depths below. And I think Driscoll cuts the vine and he falls off. But if you watch it, the lizard only has two legs.
Mm.
And that's basically where they got the design inspiration for the skull crawler.
Okay.
So just the fact that they took the monster, came up from the depths below from the original Kong, and made it the main villain. It's like the most throwaway monster in the entire first Kong film.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they picked that to make as the big bad for this film, I kind of liked that. And it made me like it a lot more, even though nothing else changed about it.
Right.
You know, so it's like I said, it's maybe a stupid reason for it, but it's kind of my reason. I like that.
Well, go
ahead, Christy.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's kind of interesting that you mentioned that, because I thought the skull crawlers were cool, but I was also responding to the whole idea that they came up from underneath the earth and all that, which we can talk about later.
Yeah.
The whole hollow earth theory, which was also kind of a really sweet callback to some of those early films like Journey to the Center of the Earth and all that stuff too. But I liked the skull crawlers. And when I said something like dinosaurs joking around, and then Mike, you were like, no, it's like a Pokemon thing or something. And I was like, oh, well,
I didn't say the Pokemon thing. I don't know who said
somebody,
that.
Somebody, I don't know. One of you guys in a message or something said, no, it's going to be like a giant Pokemon or some shit. I don't know. Somebody was joking around, I'm sure. But I was like, oh, well, I don't care. I'm going to see a dinosaur anyway. So I went in really feeling like, you know, this monster is going to suck. And I was pleasantly surprised. And I liked what they did by giving them a little bit of a culture. For example, they have this pit where they go throw up all the bones.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
They really didn't need to give us any kind of story about how these animals sort of live and process their food. And yet just kind of doing that made it a little more interesting.
Yeah, but I got flashes to the hosts. From that moment with the
I was about to reference that, Abe. Good call.
It was a really freak out moment there.
Oof. And I had a weird reaction to the skull crawlers. It's not that they didn't do their job by creating great action and being scary, but there was something weird about their eyes, the way the eyes on them look. They look almost not like they're not alive. It was really kind of freaky to me. I don't know how to describe it, but they looked like almost undead to me, and I thought that was a little weird.
The skull part is actually just bone. The eyes are actually right behind the whole hollow part.
Okay.
So, basically,
we never actually saw their eyes, is what you're telling me?
Well, they're there, but they're hard to see.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's like...
I was going to mention that there's one scene where you actually get a good shot of the eyes, which gets shot by a flare gun in the finale when the Alpha.
Oh, right. Uh-huh.
But it's kind of like a killer whale, where they have the white eye spot. And like when I was 5, I thought that was the eye.
Uh-huh.
Because animals have big, giant, white cartoon eyes.
Uh-huh.
But the real eye is actually below it. So it's sort of the same thing, that you have this skull-like appearance, but where the eye socket is isn't where the eye actually is. It's in the hole directly behind it. So, yeah, it's you really have to look close, but it's there. But, yeah, it does give them a weird look and a creepy look. And I'm with Chris. I love the fact that they give this explanation, because you do have – look, this thing that sucks about living in the modern world, besides, like, social media, is that you're not living – in the 1930s or the 1800s, there's not a whole lot of places in the world left where David Attenborough hasn't stuck in his fat nose, right? It's right. Made him special about it. And there would be, him going, and this is Kong. He's the last of his kind. And we're romanticizing and we're like, just let him fight a fucking dragon. That's we'd be sitting there. But it's, a lot of the mystery's gone out of the world. And, which is sad. But
I just had this thought randomly earlier this week, because I was out for a walk at lunch, and my cell phone rang, and the caller ID popped up on my Apple Watch, and I hit dismiss, and I thought to myself, damn, I remember when I was a kid, if the phone rang, you walked over to the wall where the phone was tethered to, and pick the phone up without even knowing who was on the other end. Just in our lifetime, so much has changed.
And sometimes with great trepidation, because you didn't know who was on the other end. It's like, right. Oh, God, please don't be Billy. Please don't be Billy. Oh, my God.
Right, but you're right. A lot of the mystery has gone out of the world, which is why I think that sometimes throwing a movie back in time like this to the 70s or the 80s, particularly pre-cell phone, I think really just adds something to a movie at this point, because you don't have to deal with all that bullshit.
So, right, and I think that was, for me, a challenge. Like, well, how are they going to do this? Because we don't live in a world of giant monkeys. We know there's no world of giant monkeys. We know there's no island perpetually surrounded by cows. Cows?
You said cows.
Been a very different, but no less interesting movie. But... how are they going to explain, where, especially when you're in an island, how does a little tiny island have all these massive giant monsters? In Jackson's Kong, he said it was, this island was once like a massive continent or a giant, an Atlantis subcontinent, mm-hmm. and it was sinking. And so as it was sinking, all the animals were getting crowded to the center of the island. But that's why it's not around anymore. And that's why we don't see these things anymore. And that's why everything's eating each other, because everything's being forced into confinement. So he kind of thought that out. Here, inner Earth. What was it called?
Hollow Earth theory.
Hollow Earth theory. Which is complete total bullshit. But so is a fucking 80-foot-tall ape. And so are skull crawlers. And so is John C. Reilly trying to beat off a monster with a katana. None of it makes sense. So I can roll with it. I mean... not going
to... What was he trying to do to the monster with the katana?
He was trying to beat him off with the katana. Christy said it was a monster porn. Pick up the subtext,
dude. It is, man. It is monster porn. Like, that's all it is. But here's the other interesting thing, though. You were talking about the Hollow Earth theory. What cracked me up about that is that was actually real. I mean, I thought that was an homage to some earlier films, like Journey to the Center of the Earth. But it was not made up. Like, people believe this
stuff.
The world
is flat.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to Greek mythology or even earlier.
But it gives you this well now for every story set in this universe, so much better than, I think, what Godzilla did, where it just sort of said there were things a long time ago that have been sleeping for 4 billion years. Okay. That this gives you a new unknown area to explore. maybe there's a movie where they go down there in the future, but it gives you an untapped well of reasons to have all this shit just starts coming out of nowhere, because it's the underground, the earth is teeming with unknown horrors, and that's where they're coming from.
Yeah,
they just happen to be leaking out onto the island a little bit at a time.
All right, so what else do we want to talk about? We talk about the monster, we talk about the hollow earth theory, natives. What did you think about the natives?
I love the pattern on their face. It was kind of these weird bars and kind of glyphs. And I also kind of like the fact they never spoke. They had small gestures. They were very different from the natives of the past films, who usually were very hostile, very vicious. I mean, almost just villains in their own right, pretty much, or just so unwilling to open up to anybody, outsiders or anyone. In this case here, they're more... I almost like to compare them to, like, monks in a way. They're very peaceful. They don't really, and they're kind of very zen in their behavior. The only time they really show any hostility is their first encounter, but, you know, afterwards they seem to be more willing to give the characters a chance. There's no little subplot of a sacrifice or anything like that. That was very often seen in the past Kong films.
And if it weren't for John C. Reilly's character, this would have been like a 30-minute movie. Because it would have been like, these natives came out of nowhere, and they all throw their spears, and they're dead.
And I got to think, though, there's some part of me that thinks that off-camera, as John C. Reilly got on the helicopters and left, one of them like went, oh, thank God, we thought he'd never leave.
Well, and I do have to go ahead.
I was going to say, but it is kind of a study in weirdness, right? Because you have, if you watch the history of the natives in all the Kong films, because you have, you know, the original, which is very, very stereotyped. Even now, I don't necessarily have a big problem with it because I don't think it's a negative portrayal, technically. But I could certainly understand why people have problems with it. And you do kind of the same thing in the 70s. And then you get the Japanese people in blackface for Kong versus Godzilla. That works well. And then when you get to Peter Jackson, he's so sensitive to that he basically makes them not identifiable as any actual population, right? So they're technically dark skin, but they have white eyes they're not hiring African Americans. They're hiring people of different ethnicities and just kind of painting them black, painting them darker, but brown, no, muddy brown, not necessarily black color. But he's trying like hard to make a non-ethnic tribe so he doesn't offend anybody, which he, by the way, failed at doing because people still found offense.
Oh yeah,
because these people are dicks. And now we've gone though to the other way, which is you have, because now we've moved Skull Island to near Vietnam instead of near Africa, and so now you have more Polynesian or Asian looking people. And you're right, what's different is also not only are they different towards people, but their relationship with Kong is different. Right? In the other films, Kong is a thing to be feared. He's their god, they worship him, but they're terrified of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're also hostile to outsiders, where here Kong is like, dude, he's a big bro.
Right.
He's looking out for us. He's our protector, you know, and we're not sacrificing anything to him. He would just watch him, like, strike superhero poses out in the middle of the island, you know, as he eats squid. And you know, but that changes the relationship by having a different Kong. It has different natives, and that therefore changes how they interact with John C. Reilly, who keeps all the other white people from getting speared.
Right.
Well, and I think, too, you know, I did have in my notes that I actually loved how beautifully the world of that indigenous population to that island was created. I thought that the ruins were really beautiful and interesting, and I thought those ruins looked really familiar to me, and I was almost wondering if they were a callback to one of the ruins in one of the other Kong movies. But I didn't get a chance to actually watch any of that to find out. I just was too busy this week. I loved the creepy moment where, you know, she takes the picture and the eyes open and come out of the walls. But the villages, the ruins, the wall that they had built.
I was on the three-dimensional art in the cave.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It was all very artful, and it was otherworldly, but it was exotic at the same time. And so I thought it was really believable. Like, not that 3D art was kind of what I mentioned, because what was cool about that is if you shift it, like if the people looking at it shifted their weight a little bit or stood a little differently, a different part of the story was revealed.
Right.
Did you guys notice that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I liked, I did not think that this was stereotypical at all. I thought they took something and were just completely original. I love the way when they open the gate at the end and it opens like a big mouth.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I thought they did really well.
Another thing that kind of, you know me, but when they opened the wall for the boat to get out, why was the wall rigged like that? Did the natives have any boats? I didn't see any.
I didn't see any either.
Anyway, it was maybe, just a thing I noticed.
Maybe when they get their friendly protector whale.
Kong versus Orca.
Maybe Kong likes to bathe, yeah. There's a gigantic river dolphin that comes and saves them from the giant squid.
I was really truly wondering though about that wall and how strong it actually was.
Yeah,
because I'm looking at that wall, I'm going, dude, all these animals are like huge. They could just freaking smash this thing. Like, I don't know.
Because on one side there's like spikes and stakes sticking out there, and you see tips of them covered in blood. So things have tried to get in there and passed. But at the same time too. When they are raising the wall to let the boat through, makeshift boat through, it doesn't go one big giant like wall piece. It kind of goes like little sections, kind of like a curtain being raised.
Right.
Yeah, it was cool. It was an interesting design. I've never seen a design like that.
I like the design.
It was cool.
I don't understand why the natives would have had it rigged like that. That's all.
Yeah. But it just wonders, like, if it was easy to raise it, then I think it'd be easy for one of those beasts like that, those giant octopuses to smash through.
Good point.
Speaking of the octopus, though, that was another callback to the old Kong films in King Kong vs. Godzilla, where Kong fights a giant octopus on his first appearance.
And I have to admit that part of me is a little disappointed because this fight's over really quick. But you know, when I thought about it, yeah, it probably would be.
Yeah, I'm right.
But that was something else, honestly, that I appreciated about this movie too. There's a reason I just don't go for a whole lot of like superhero movies now and stuff like that, because suddenly everybody thinks that it's really amazing to have a 25-minute action sequence or a 12-minute action sequence without any break or without anything. And I just think that I find that incredibly boring. And half of me was going into this movie thinking the monsters had better be cool. Because if it's just going to be 15 or 20 minutes a couple of times of Kong smashing helicopters, I'm going to be really bored. And I'm glad that they didn't do that. I thought that the action was well spaced. I thought all of it was interesting. I thought it was all the appropriate length so that, you know, and that squid fight that he did was awesome, but it was just enough. Like, right. They seriously could have gone on for twice as long if they wanted to, and they didn't. And even, like, when in the end, the big battle with Samuel Jackson, that moved pretty quickly. And I liked how they broke up the final battle with the skull crawler. And I will say that him ripping his stomach out by yanking his tongue was amazing.
It was.
I was
yes. And they play with your expectations the first time when Kong grabs the skull crawler's jaws and he's pulling it apart. You're thinking like he's going to go for the classic T-Rex jaw snapping moment.
Yeah,
but it subverts it because he's too young to do it. He's not strong enough to pull it off yet. So you wonder, like, okay, if they're not going to snap the creature's jaw, how are they going to beat him? And then it just you had the stomach rip, you know, being ripped out and everything like that. But you also had the fucking anchor swing. You tried propeller.
The that propeller was pretty cool.
Being used like a... Not just like a giant flail, but he also uses like a bladed brass knuckles too to smash the thing's head in. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really cool.
Well, and Kong being smart is always good. Now you're talking about the fight at the end with the giant alpha skull crawler. There's the moment with, was it Cole that was the dude with the grenades?
Cole.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So there's a moment where Cole tells everybody else, "You guys go on. I'm gonna make my stand here."
And oh, jeez!
He takes a grenade in each hand and pulls the pin, and goes walking towards this giant skull crawler, and he's ready to get eaten and blow up inside its stomach. And the thing just bitch slaps him with its tail, and he goes flying into the mountain and explodes. And I laughed out loud, and people around me did not think it was funny. I got some glares. But I just thought that was so fucking perfect, because it's totally not what you're expecting.
The thing is, what I loved is I liked that character so much. Right? And he's sort of a battle-hardened vet, and he's a little quirky, he's got a good sense of humor, he seems like a decent guy. You know, he's not a psychopath. So they're going to give him a good ending. And, man, they don't even give him that. They just... So I understand people being upset, but I would have laughed with...
Yeah. But it goes back to our point about the lack of glorious heroic sacrifices and hero deaths. Because every death that comes to most of the major characters, even the minor characters, just are fucking horrific. Most of the guys are either getting ripped apart by giant blade-faced birds, other people being eaten alive, John Goodman among them, other people get impaled by spiders, and even Jack, too, just gets squashed under a monkey fist. Like, everyone's death is not like hero deaths, but... Yeah, part of me knew that the bombs were not going to work because, you know, it could not be one of the humans to take this thing down. It had to be Kong. But my God, it was like a fucking watching a home run go flying over the fence.
But you have to admit that Kong couldn't have done it by himself. He had to work with the humans.
Well, he needed the propeller.
He needed the propeller, and he needed them with their 50 cal machine gun to distract the fucking thing for a minute while he was tied up in the chains.
I think, too, we were talking about, you know, earlier Mike was saying that hands were such a big symbol in this movie. And I liked to think that the hands and the cutting of the hands and the bleeding of the hands was really about control and who's in control. Is it man or is it nature? Because one of the themes that is frequently addressed in these monster movies is who really owns the earth, so to speak. Is it man? Is it nature? Man exhibits this hubris and then, you know, gets squashed, which is what I think the whole Icarus tie-in thing comes from, that Samuel L. Jackson was bragging about earlier. But one of the other things I noticed they did a lot with in this film was eyes. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of focusing on eyes. And I took that to mean that it was sort of a symbol... not necessarily of communication and understanding between Kong and the people or the other monsters or whatever, but a sense of commonality. The eyes are the windows to our souls, right? If you want to be cliche. And so by focusing on the eyes, I think the point that was being made was that, you know, we all come from the same place. We all have a soul. Even if we are in different bodies. And that's just kind of what I got out of it. Because even the guy that you liked who got smashed at the end on the cliff, which I was so disappointed in that, Eric. I was like, that's terrible.
I thought it was hilarious. It was
so terrible. But I felt bad for the guy because, like Mike said, I liked him. But even then, in that moment where he's sitting there waiting and trying to draw the monster to him, they're focusing on his eyes. So they're trying to show like a common that anyway. That's just what I got out of it.
Yeah. There's three moments I recall when eyes really get a major close ups. There's the early part where the helicopter team is bombing, and we get a nice visor shot of one of the helicopter pilots kind of watching the explosions, smiling. Before Kong throws a tree at their helicopter. Another moment is the focus on Jackson's eyes while he watches Kong after the helicopter battle. And then there's also the final shot of the film in which we focus on Kong's eyes reflecting the helicopters as he's roaring in rage. It's seen the last shot in which Kong kind of sees the helicopters reflecting in his eyes. Almost like he was... What I got from that moment, was that Kong, after his encounter with the humans, after being attacked, having his home damaged, and after everything else, acquired his own kind of trauma. And seeing the helicopters again kind of brought that out.
Okay. All right. I think he already had trauma when his parents got killed by the skull crawler.
Yeah, but I think towards humans, though.
Towards humans. Okay, because fair enough.
No, you know, it's ambiguous whether Kong's going to, you know, even after meeting Hiddleston and Larson's characters, all the other humans, most of them had tried to kill him numerous occasions. And the first thing he saw when guards to man was those helicopters that attacked his home, shot him up, cut his hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was kind of, you know, he was already dealing with his own trauma, being the last of his kind, fighting the skull crawlers for God knows how long.
But not to mention having to eat raw octopus. I mean,
yeah. But calamari's pretty good. So,
ew.
Not wiggly.
Learn to live a little.
No. Tentacles. But, no. No. Anyway.
You know what? Was anybody else, speaking of Eric, before you were saying that there was something that bugged you when you were talking about things that bugged you? I have two that actually bugged me. First of all, somebody in the movie said, "Bitch, please."
That was Sam Jackson, yep.
Yeah, and so not
only,
70s.
He's actually the only person on the 70s. Planet that's allowed to say that.
Really? Oh, my God. Okay, well, if that was an inside joke, that just took me right out of the 70s world. That really disappointed me. I was like, dude, they did not say that shit in the 70s.
Yeah, you're
after
right about
all
that.
This meticulous work these people did, they're going to ruin it with that one anachronism. But now, I guess,
all right,
it was a joke. So
it was an anachronism, but both times my theater laughed. So I can't say that it... And I don't think anyone would go, "Hey, that's not a 73 joke." Look, I get it. I understand those little things tend to eat at me a bit, but it's a gag. And hey, we don't know who started saying it, right?
Yeah, right? That's true.
Maybe that's where it began.
Maybe. And the other thing I have to mention, too, because I've seen it in a lot of movies right now, especially in the superhero movies, and it's actually starting to bug me. What is with all of this fucking slow motion in these action things? I mean, I don't understand
the point
of it.
Blame that on the Matrix, Christy.
I know in the Matrix, it had a story sense to it. There was a point to it. There was. Or like another movie that recently did it, there was a superhero movie where the guy was playing the Flash or something. And so they had to show him in slow motion as he's changing people because he was going so fast that everybody around him was slow. That I don't mind. But now, like, every movie, it's like, it's just so cheesy and gimmicky, and all it says to me is, see how awesome our special effects are, number one, or see how honestly our special effects really suck because we have to give them to you in slow motion so you can understand what the hell is going on. They're like showing the, you know, the helicopter falling in slow motion. I'm like, Jesus, I know the helicopter's falling out of the sky. Like, leave it. So it's just getting irritating now because they did it.
Didn't really notice the slow motion.
But here's what's really sad. They didn't do it in any of the monster things. when it would have been cool to see the monsters so you could get a better look at them. They did it during stupid shit like the helicopters or the fires or whatever.
Sorry, I disagree. The helicopters were not stupid. I thought that scene was fantastic.
I did not like the slow motion, and I didn't think we need it. And I'm getting really tired of seeing it in all these movies.
Well, it's not necessary. To the movies.
I think the slow motion with the helicopters, and I agree, some cases it can be overdone. I think the slow, what I liked about it was the way it captured the blades, right? It's the blades were moving very slowly, mm-hmm. and it just got this idea of the helicopter sort of dancing through the jungle. It was right before all the chaos erupted. Right.
Don't misunderstand me. I don't mind it like once. I just noticed it a lot in this movie. It was like every time I turned around, we were doing more slow-mo. And I was like, oh, my God, didn't we just do slow-mo like 5 minutes ago? I mean, just be smart. I think it's just being overused at this point as a gimmick.
Matrix,
they don't use it that much. It's
you
a couple
could be
of
right,
cool
but
minutes.
I think you're also looking for it, whereas I was not looking for it and didn't even really register with me.
Right. We've gotten used to it. So I do want to point out, maybe this will make you feel a little better, Christy, that I've gone online, where, as we know, is the source of all authoritative knowledge.
It's on the internet. It must be true.
And it is true. And so I went to the ironclad source of urbandictionary.com.
Oh, come on, dude. That's not even Wikipedia.
And it says, I'm just saying, if this helps... Bitch, please. A phrase originally used by pimps in the 70s used to express disbelief and authority towards one with the audacity to try your ass. Also said to stupid people who dare try you. For example, he says, I'll bust yo monkey ass, and you say, huh? Bitch, please. Or, O says, I'm sorry, but I couldn't get no money, daddy. Pimp slaps her and says, bitch, please, now go get me my money. That's from a 2005 entry in Urban Dictionary.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, if it's on the internet, it has to be true.
I totally learned. I can go out and be a 1970s prostitute for Halloween now.
Or pimp. Don't sell yourself short. You could be a pimp.
Oh, I could be a pimp. Okay.
Well, I'm going out on a limb. I'm going out on a limb and saying that you probably were not hanging out with a lot of 70s pimps.
Let's get back on track. What else do we want to say about Kong?
Did anybody notice that, you know, when they swallowed, when the younger skull crawler swallowed John Goodman with the camera and it was flashing
the
in
camera,
his stomach?
Yeah.
That was totally a callback to Jurassic Park 3 with the satellite phone and the Spinosaurus gut.
Oh, could have been.
Okay, I can see that.
Yes.
Well,
tell he was coming, or where he was.
You mentioned it, but you all caught the Jurassic Park 1 reference, right?
Be more specific.
When the helicopters are taking off and they go into the storm, and Sam Jackson tells everyone to hold on to their butts.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh okay. Yeah.
Because he said that in the first movie, hold on to your butts.
But yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay. Wow.
So I've been pretty critical of the characters in this movie. We had a discussion about Sam Jackson. We've talked a little bit about John C. Reilly and John Goodman. Did anybody else have anything to say about any of the characters in particular?
Well, again, this is sort of that I like the characters. I think what was interesting is that I wouldn't say any of them are red shirts. Well, most of them aren't red shirts, because red shirts are literally like the nameless, faceless characters.
Right.
That are just there for body work. And this was something where I could not have pinpointed, with the exception of Sam Jackson, necessarily. If you told me to play the game Who Lives, Who Dies, I would have pegged some of the characters and been off on others.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're going to tell me three soldiers survived, I would have said Cole would have been one of them, but he obviously wasn't. We all know Sam Jackson was fucked.
Yeah.
All right. We all know he was going. I wasn't sure if John Goodman would make it. And the order, like the guy who was the...
Brie Larson had to make it.
Right. The captain who got his deal with American Airlines or United, whichever it was, who ends up being eaten by the skull crawler after sitting on the stick insect.
Right.
You know, he was kind of set up to be one of the more main characters.
And that whole... I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt. that whole fucking thing with Dear Billy. Oh my god. I just wanted to tear my eyes out. That was so cheesy.
Oh, I think if that's all there was to it, I kind of would agree, but I like the fact that everyone was giving them each other shit for their letters from home and their letters to home. How many times you write her? I wrote her like every week. How many letters you got back from her? Four. Oh, your mama loves you. You know, just...
Right, right.
So I kind of like that because it was showing
that's
up...
That's true. That was kind of a theme, like an underlying theme in that. And I thought that might have shown that people at war are so separated from their loved ones, not only physically, but also in that, you know, the experience of war, people at home, your loved ones at home are never going to know what you went through.
Yeah, I think there's just too many characters. They don't handle them all well. Right, like, there's the lead Landsat guy. I can't remember the actor who plays him. It's one of those character actors I've seen a million places before. Not the guy with the mustache and the Brillo head, but the tall, skinny guy.
Well, and here's the thing, is that
at one point I didn't realize he was still alive, and there he was. You know, and trying to keep track of who was in which group. You know, I had that trouble with originally with John Goodman. Oh, right, he's alive and he's with the Sam Jackson group. I don't remember how that happened, but okay. And then there were huge amounts of time where, like, John Goodman had nothing to do because his job was literally to come in, set up the story,
and die.
And got nothing after this. I'm just going to walk around with you guys. Maybe I'll head out early for lunch.
And part of my issue with the whole thing is that I understand what Christy's saying about the themes of war and whatnot, but at the same time, essentially, 60% of these, probably more than 60% of the characters we meet in the movie, their job is to show up and die. So it like I think that any time spent with them trying to develop that camaraderie in this particular movie is wasted. Because there's not enough for it to matter for me to actually care, and then they all die. So I just thought it was a waste of my time. That's all.
Yeah, I didn't mind in particular the shallow characters. I kind of expected them, because let's face it, in most of the big monster movies I love to watch over and over, that's what you get. You know, it's kind of like that romance that I mentioned where, you know, it's basically, oh, we don't like each other. And then we have a moment of peace. And then something trauma happens and the guy comforts the girl or vice versa. And then the guy saves the girl and they hug and kiss at the end and get together. But you see nothing. Right. That was what I was saying about. And I expected that. And I actually enjoyed that. I was like, this is so much fun to see a romance just come out of nowhere. With nothing. No sex, no nothing. It's, oh, I put my hand on your shoulder. Oh, they're in love. We're just supposed to imply that, right?
Yeah.
But it's true. That's what all those 50s movies did. Yeah. All of a sudden, they're kissing and don't leave me. Don't leave me to go kill the monster because I love you. Oh, really? Because you only spent time talking to each other. But okay. Yeah. And I just, so I kind of was not minding any of the bullshit with the characters because I was totally just expecting that these people were just going to be cardboard and they weren't going to go anywhere. So maybe
I was expecting that too, but you were clearly willing to deal with it and I was not.
I think one thing is a real plus though is that, you know, that we, the creatures and the characters are more balanced in terms of presence than how it was when the Godzilla film where it almost felt like instead of a Godzilla film, it felt like a Monsters 2.1.
Yeah. Because
basically we have Bryan Cranston, who we think for the most part is going to be our main character, but they don't do a whole lot with him.
They Why did we ever off, think he was going to?
And then we get stuck with Army Guy 95 and his wife and some random scientists and guys and whatever people were in the film, and the two Mutos, who honestly felt like more the stars of the film than Godzilla did. And so there was a shift, there was an imbalance in terms of presence, in terms of what the film was supposed to be like, in terms of, I mean, there was too much tease in that film, not enough payoff. In this case here, We get plenty of good monster moments, some character scenes, and some in between. So I didn't mind the characters too much if they were not exactly three-dimensional. I liked most of them. For me, they carried the same cheesy feel I loved in those old films. So
I agree with you. I think maybe that's what I'm picking up on is that. But I do agree with you also that it's well balanced, so you didn't mind it. It wasn't like we had to watch 40 minutes of cheesy, badly developed characters or cardboard characters, and then we get the monster. At least it was broken up by a lot of cool monster stuff in between, so it didn't really feel like...
Well, okay, that did make it a little more bearable.
Yeah, but Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, though, is structured the same way. The only reason I know that is because I literally just watched it, like, last night or something. That's the only reason.
Right. Well, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of arc, you know, say, in the original Kong either. Most of the characters aren't that changed by their experience, except that Jack suddenly loves Anne for no good reason. He just looks at her and says, "Say,
you're hot.
I think I love you." Okay.
But of course, that's the way great romance works, don't you know?
Yes, I know. But like, all right, and look, as much as I still really love the recent Godzilla film, but like, I thought one of the problem is it Aaron Taylor Johnson? What's his name? The actor?
Oh, that was the right name.
Yeah, and he, I don't know what it is. He doesn't carry that film. He does not have any charisma in the film, and they give him a shitload of time. And you just don't grab onto him as a person, right? And as opposed to here, where I think, you know, you have a lot more charisma from most of the actors are oozing charisma in some cases. And so even if, like, you go back and, no, Tom Hiddleston didn't necessarily have a lot to do, you know, although he was there as the guide. But you also had to be a civilian, because the whole thing is to set up sort of the civilians versus the military. So you needed some people on the civilian, the non-military side, to have that point of view, because otherwise, where's my anti-war movie? So you got him there, and he got to look cool by putting on a gas mask and then letting a stuntman run through the gas and machete thing. But they're fun to watch. They're enjoyable. I was not really bored by any of the characters. I didn't think that they didn't have any moments. And I think the real heart of the film is John C. Reilly.
Oh, absolutely.
And he's the one
character I did not mind.
Right. And first of all, he has something of an arc. Not a great one, right?
Well, but at least it's there. Yeah.
The problem is the entire arc happens during the opening credits.
Right,
because he's the soldier at war. He's the pilot. And you do the whole enemy mine thing. He crash lands on the island mm-hmm. with a Japanese pilot, and then they come face to face with Kong. Apparently Kong says you two need to sit down and resolve your differences because they turn into best buds. And I'm a little disappointed that the Japanese pilot doesn't make it to the modern era.
Yeah, my husband said that too. He said, I really would have liked to have seen a little of that. It would have been interesting.
Right.
Well, part of me thinks that, like, I wonder if, like, you know, back in the day when they made Dracula, they filmed the Bela Lugosi movie, and then at night they filmed the Spanish movie with the same exact sets, the same script, except in Spanish with Spanish actors. So part of me wonders if there's like a Kong movie out there where John C. Reilly dies and the Japanese guy survives. And
well, Mike, you were talking about how...
And the Chinese scientist is really the star of the film.
Well, yeah, that's what I was about to say. The Chinese scientist, you said how she's probably just there to satisfy Chinese interest who invested in the movie. Well, guess what? The Chinese and the Japanese don't get along that well. So maybe that's why the Japanese pilot died.
So yeah, and then but you also have them. You know, he has to come out. It's like, can he be coaxed to come back into civilization because he's so resolved to his fate, and he is a little bonkers. And just to be able to see him go home and watch a Cubs game.
Yeah, that was cool.
And know that he probably lived long enough to die right before they won the World Series.
Right.
Well, here was my question. Did anybody else, though, think his wife looked a little young and, like, his son looked a little too young for 30 years?
Well, oddly enough, his son was him. The actor, I'm pretty sure the actor who played himself at the beginning of the film, as a pilot, is also the actor who played him at the end.
It's just the kid didn't look like he was 30.
Eh.
He looked like he was too young.
No, yeah, I didn't look like I was 30 when I was 30.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. But I think my favorite John C. Reilly line, though,
is
when they're in the when they're in the woods and you hear the things, and he goes, "You see, they sound like birds, right?" And they're all like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Yeah, those are fucking ants." I love
sound like
that.
Birds,
I thought that was
fucking
fantastic.
Now, do you know that originally that was, if I remember correctly, because they originally cast J.K. Simmons in the Sam Jackson role. And Michael Keaton in the John C. Reilly role.
What? That, no. I
that think would have been disappointing. Choice. I love John C. Reilly. I mean, everything
I
I've ever
too.
Seen him do is just fun. He's always great. I mean, I loved him in The Perfect Storm. I don't know. I've loved him in everything I've seen him in. He's never disappointed me. But
right. He's a terrific Sasquatch in Tenacious D and The Pick of Destiny.
The thing is, it would have been very different, because if you had Michael Keaton, it would have been less comical and more crazy, I suspect. Right?
Yeah.
But I could see him doing that, you know, in a much different way, that in that sort of tense, scary way of those are fucking ants, you know, instead of John C. Reilly's kind of can you believe this shit sort of way.
Yeah, like laughing it off, like, yeah, those are fucking ants.
That one scene where he's like, oh, you're a fine group of boys. We're all going to die together.
And the way he says it, you know there's like a story. Like, so when he says they're fucking ants, you just know that, like, at some point, I'm like out having a picnic, I hear the birds, I start calling the birds, and there's fucking ants coming down out of the tree. You know there's some story behind it, right? That's... Oh, he's like, I couldn't believe it either. I still can't believe it. They're fucking ants. Oh my god. But yeah, but he's fun. And again, the audience. I mean, it's you know, you can not go wrong by playing up to veteran porn, right? Right now,
right.
And so they hit all the right buttons with him, and then showing him going home and with his wife and. Making sure she gave him a hot dog and a beer so he could put his feet up and watch the game. Apparently not at all amazed that there being color television in his living room. But
oh boy. And then of course there's the post-credit scene. Post-credit scene basically end up with Brie Larson and what's his fuck being debriefed. And they're basically brought into Monarch. Who tells them, guess what? Kong ain't the only one. And basically shows them a slideshow, or it's actually a reel of motion pictures of pictures, I guess?
Cave paintings.
Cave paintings, which depict Godzilla and Mothra and... Rodan. Is Godzilla in there?
No, it's Godzilla, Rodan, and Ghidorah.
King Ghidorah's in there. The Hydra. Yeah. He's like the Hydra one, right, Abe?
Yep.
Yeah, the three-headed golden dragon.
Yeah. Okay.
So basically, they show you at the end that there's evidence of all these other monsters, including Godzilla. And then the very last thing you hear as the movie goes to black is Godzilla's roar from the 2014 film, which I recognized immediately, which is weird, because I've only watched that movie once, and it was 3 years ago, and I still was like, yep, that's Godzilla.
Well, they used elements of his roar. I mean, it's hard to miss that, the way, especially the tail off of his roar.
Right.
Very distinct, yeah. And a certain screech. I still always wonder, like, I'm thinking, okay, I'm sitting here, it's like, oh my god, a giant dinosaur. Oh my god, a pteranodon. Oh my god, a three-headed dragon. A moth.
A moth? What? Mothra was the one I never understood.
It's a moth.
Especially I actually got around to watching the movie. Oh my god, is that a fucking whacked out movie?
It's a moth.
The two little miniature women.
Yeah.
Come on, tell me. Tell me you don't want two miniature women in pillbox hats on your counter.
I do not. I do not want them anywhere near me.
I actually have the RSS feed to the little girl porn, the miniature 6-inch girl porn site. So yeah, let's.
So anyway, they totally set it up for there to be a Kong versus Godzilla, which I hope I get to see. That's going to be pretty cool.
Yeah, it's actually going to go Godzilla versus Godzilla, Mothra, and Rodan versus King Ghidorah, and then King Kong versus Godzilla is going to come afterwards.
But, yeah, King Kong versus Godzilla, I believe Abe is slated for 2020 right now.
Yes, and
what a bunch of crap! It needs to come next year.
Yeah, and Godzilla 2 might be like 2019 or something like that.
Nobody gives a shit about those other monsters. We want Kong and Godzilla.
Fuck it, I want those monsters. I love Rodan.
I want the other monsters.
Well, fine, do the other monsters. Do them after Kong and Godzilla.
You got to build up to Kong.
No, I want Kong and Godzilla.
Oh, wow, they got the release dates right here. March 22nd, 2019 for Godzilla King of the Monsters. And then May 29th, 2020 for Godzilla vs. King Kong.
All right, I'll just have to be patient.
You don't
I'm
have
not
a choice.
Good at being patient.
Well, here's my suggestion is build the time machine, and you never have to be patient again.
But I got to be careful about hooking up with my own mom.
Well, not if you go to the future to catch the movies you can't wait for.
Well,
then
okay,
he'll, then he'll hook up with his daughter. That would be worse.
Well, I mean, if she's hot.
Is there anything else we want to talk about, Kong?
Actually, there is one other thing I do want to mention, which may or may not even be true, but I just loved this. The John C. Reilly character and his former enemy, who is a Japanese Zero pilot, with whom he had crash-landed at the beginning of the film, had been working on a boat to get them off the island, and they made it out of a B-29, a B-51, and a Zero. And I really, really loved this moment for a couple of different reasons. The B-59 was also made into a boat in the film The Last Flight of Noah's Ark, Eric, which I was talking about earlier.
Right, I still got to get that from Netflix.
Yep, which was actually part of the reason why I was so hot to rewatch it was not only because my new Blu-ray came, but because of this reference. Gotcha. The Last Flight of Noah's Ark was a Disney adventure film, and it came out in 1980. If you see it today, it actually holds up really well. But what's interesting there is that in that film, there are some Japanese pilots from World War II who have no idea that the war has ended. So they, too, are stranded on that island, but they've been there for 30 years, have no idea the war has ended. They also help once they overcome the idea that, you know, Noah and his crew are not their enemies and that the war is over. They also help build a boat. So there's three similarities there. They use a B-29 as a boat to get off the island. That both the Japanese pilots and John C. Reilly don't know the war is over. Both have been stuck on the island for 30 years. And both sets of castaways have to set aside their adversarial positions to be friends.
Cool.
So that they can survive. And I just thought that was really interesting because that is, and I'm sitting here thinking, are there other movies that use pieces of a B-29 specifically to make into a boat? And I couldn't come up with
any. I recognized it, but I didn't know where it was from, and now I do.
Now, well, yeah, I mean, hey, listen, they could have made it up, but it was too close for me. I'm like, somebody did this as an homage, maybe. You know, I was like having fun with it.
Well,
it
one like, thing oh, is that
go ahead.
That I noticed that it's I think pretty clear that the cockpit there was what they used as the model for the Millennium Falcon cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
And I swear to God that there are several moments in that film, in this film, where they use the sound effects from the Millennium Falcon breaking down in Empire Strikes Back.
Oh,
yeah,
that would be
could have
cool.
a point actually.
Oh.
You're trying to get the thing running.
Yeah, I could swear. I mean, now maybe it's a coincidence and they're just using the same ones from the library. Maybe I'm hearing things, but I don't know.
It's similar,
I
to be sure.
I know the sound of that film really, really well. Yeah, and I swear to God, they're the same noises.
When the engine is failing to start, it kind of sounds like the failing hyperdrive.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God! Now I can't wait to get the movie and on DVD and listen to it.
Good call, Mike.
Yeah, that's good. That's the kind of stuff that's always so much fun to look for in movies, I think. You know?
Oh, Easter egg.
Well,
yeah.
I know that that Mike's definitely heard me talk about the Wilhelm scream before. I can't remember if Abe was on the show, and I know Christy wasn't. Are you too familiar with the Wilhelm scream?
Oh, I'm definitely familiar with it, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Because I can, whenever it's in a movie now, I can identify it immediately. And
I still have trouble. I know what it is, but I still have trouble picking it out. But maybe it's just because I'm not tuned, like, actively listening to for it, you know?
My brothers think I'm insane because every once in a while we watch this stuff and I'll just turn to one of them and go, Wilhelm scream. And I'll just go, what? And I'll say, that was a Wilhelm scream. What the? And I'll be like, I told you, you forgot. Never mind. cool. So if we're getting ready to wrap this up, I can send Phil a text and we can give our final thoughts. Sound like
I
a plan?
I'm good. I think I pretty much said everything I needed to say.
Yeah.
You good, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I would just, where would you guys put this if, depending on, if on, let's
best try that again. Best movies of the year?
Kong
movies?
The slate of Kong movies. Because you don't have a lot of them. They're not like Godzilla movies where there's 98,000 of them.
Right.
You really have Kong, yeah. Son of Kong, versus Godzilla remake.
The original best, followed by 2005, followed by Skull Island, followed by 76.
For me, I think it'd be the original King Kong, 2005. I really actually like, despite its flaws. This one definitely. For cheese factor, though, I really always had fun with King Kong vs. Godzilla just because it's so corny and fun. And then pretty much everything else within that category for me.
Okay. Christy?
I don't know. I think I'm leaning toward Eric's list.
Okay.
I think I agree with you exactly. The 2005 one I have not seen in so long, but I remember just enjoying it. And I don't understand why everybody gives it a bad rap. I thought it was fun.
It's because of the first hour of the movie. That's why.
I liked it.
Well, I think it's a weird thing. It's sort of like I had a discussion with somebody else online. I think it's just sort of like Avatar, where people came out and everybody saw it. They enjoyed it in the theaters. They liked it. But then the meme started about how it was just Pocahontas.
I didn't see those. Avatar.
Sorry. And it's got a point.
Yeah. You're talking about King Kong.
But no, but that's the one. But that's what, that's all people would talk about, and they just keep harping on it and hitting it and hitting it. And I think it's tarnished the memory of it, maybe unfairly. And I think with Kong, it's 3.5 hours long. It's 3.5 hours for, and that's not the extended version.
It's the first hour of the movie.
Right, and it takes forever, but everything is just so big. He doesn't fight a Tyrannosaurus Rex; he fights three of them, and then they suspend
his list,
minds,
Mike?
And it keeps going. So I think that's all people would talk about, and when all you talk about is the negative stuff, that's all that sticks with you. I think when people go back and rewatch it, there really is a lot of good stuff in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I would go original. I would go the 2005 flavor. I would then go with the hot and spicy Apocalypse Kong, and then finally the greasy, fatty, oily 1976 version. And
which I watched again recently.
Yeah, and I want to say, which if you have Amazon Prime, you can watch on Amazon Prime.
Yep.
And here's my recommendation to you. Whether you agree with the argument or not, just for fun, anytime someone wants to argue how terrible CGI is and how awesome practical effects are, go find a clip, 1976, King Kong versus Giant Snake. Because that is pretty. That the giant snake in that looks like they got it off a carnival's thoroughfare. You know, it just they popped the balloon, they won the snake. It's awful, and this was a big budget movie for the time.
Yeah, it was.
And there are things I really like about that film, and it's amazing how it goes. Like I think that the design in the on Skull Island, I think in the wall and what they do with the villagers, and I thought it's just great art design and set design. And then you get to the scene with the snake, and it looks like they're on the set from an episode of the original Star Trek.
All
with
right.
A man in a monkey suit.
And we've got Phil back online, and welcome back,
Phil.
Oh,
here comes Phil.
Hey, Phil!
Yes, I'm ready to get your list here of King Kong movies.
Good news is, Phil, that Lily sat in for you.
Yes, she was walking around.
Yep.
I would say, obviously, the original by far, but I haven't seen any of the others for a long time, including the Jackson one, but based off of... My empathy.
Memory?
Yeah, memory. Or the empathy of the memory is the 70 whatever one, the Jeff Bridges one, like second best. And then the Jackson one third, and then the Japanese versus Godzilla ones after that.
So what about Skull Island? Where does it fall in there?
Oh, right. Skull Island. I haven't rewatched the 75 or 6 one recently, but I remember enjoying it tremendously as a kid. But since you guys are saying it's cheesy now, maybe I put Skull Island ahead to that.
Okay.
Well, I would say, again, if you have Amazon Prime, watch it. It's there. And you can decide for yourself how much of it works for you, how much of it doesn't.
Right. And that's what I'll probably rewatch it. But just based off of memory, I think I enjoyed it more than Skull Island. But then again, the last time I saw it was when I was like, 12-year-old kid or whatever.
Nostalgia is powerful.
It is.
Yeah. I will say he is the perviest Kong out of all the Kongs.
He is. He tries to take off Jessica Lange's top.
Well... Right. And I think, and we do kind of mock the monkey in the suit, but you compare that Kong suit to, I don't know, the 70s Godzilla suits.
Yeah.
Like Megalon and...
I mean, it's pretty good for a suit.
It's pretty good for a man in suit monster, and especially the animatronics in the face, but like there's the scene where he paws at Jessica Lange, and he blows on her to dry her off.
Yeah, I remember that.
And they try to, and they show him smiling, and it's this sort of like pervy, creepy smile.
It really is.
He's like, "All right, white girl, take the top off now for me."
All right. So I think we all pretty much gave our summary at the beginning. Does anybody have any final thoughts on the movie, Abe? How about you?
Well, overall, I mean, this is a fun monster film. Also agree and agree with that. I think this was really serves up the adventure of visiting an incredible place as Skull Island. The characters are not exactly deep, but they also have a fun little presence. It's a great ride overall. It's definitely something to go see in the big screen. Heck, maybe even IMAX if you can get the chance to do so. I can't really vouch for that, but I can imagine if having fun seeing the film like as I did on big screen and a regular theater, take up till times 11 at an IMAX, something like that, it should be a blast. So go see it still in the theaters if you haven't had a chance to, and have fun.
Mike?
I saw this sold out at IMAX, or almost sold out at IMAX on opening weekend, and then I saw it again a week later, also an almost sold out theater. And it was one of those theaters with those fancy new theater that you got, Eric.
Yeah.
And how they have like the seats where the handicap seats are.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have the space for the wheelchair, so you have like two seats together, but then there's nothing else in the row.
We all know what it is, Mike. Get to your point.
I'm getting to that. Hang on. So. because it was mostly sold out and I was getting my tickets at the last minute, I kind of had to take the seat there next to a stranger, which is a little weird. I guess it was a father there. His kids were sitting in the row in front of us. And at the end of the movie, the kids were, like, thrilled. And they're like, the best movie ever! I was like, Phil! And, but they really enjoyed it. And so, I mean, that's what this film is going for. It's going for the 9-year-old, right? It's not looking for the 28-year-old pretentious douchebag film critic.
Right.
And don't get me wrong, there's a place for the 28-year-old pretentious douchebag film critic. But within every 28-year-old pretentious film douchebag film critic, there is also an inner 9-year-old that you can tap, and that's the one that you need to bring to this.
Mike, you can argue that it's going after the same audience as the Transformer films or the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle films, for that
matter. Right. I just think it does it better than those films.
Well, of course, yeah.
And there's the gruesomeness, like pulling out the guts, right, of the monsters. Mm-hmm. And that's what the kids love. That's what I love, when Kong kills the snake in 76, and you see the mouth torn apart. You know, I was like, oh, that's so gross. You know? And
yeah, that's
kids
so
love
gross.
That shit.
Yep.
And when you do it in the context of a monster, it's not as bad as if you're doing it in the context of a human being. People, right. Kids can, it gives enough distance that kids can enjoy the gooey shit. It's a fun movie. Go enjoy it and enjoy it and have fun with it and watch the monsters get beaten up by Kong.
Christy, your thoughts?
Well, I couldn't agree more with what both of you said. This is monster porn. It's the 5-minute romance. It's the Easter eggs. It's in the spirit of everything that made the 9 and 10-year-old monster lovers in us become the adults that we are today. So go have fun. That's really, I'm just supporting everything you guys said because you guys really said it all better than I did. So.
Okay.
What about me?
I'm getting you, Phil. Calm down. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. I'll just read my quick review I did on the Facebook group, which is as follows. Kong, Skull Island, quick immediate review. The first 50 minutes of the film is fairly mediocre. The characterizations are not good, and they are done either too quickly or glossed over. The cast is very diverse, which is good, but they felt, unfortunately, like Hollywood tokens. The Chinese woman felt maybe Legendary Pictures being owned by a Chinese conglomerate was the reason. If one wants to get good characterization of people in a film similar to this, James Cameron's Aliens is where to start, or Oliver Stone's Platoon. But this was a weak point for sure. Plenty of obvious red shirts. Brie Larson's character made no sense. For her to even be on the trip was stupid. They should have made her a character photographer that was in the military or something, and then it would have worked. Also, Hiddleston's character was worthless. The two of them felt to me like a GQ and Cosmopolitan shoot. And a couple of minor nitpicks for this film was things like the very next day, people were looked as if they had shaven, and yet they didn't have midnight shower. Yeah, maybe that's what it is, but it seemed like they were cut, clean skin, and it shouldn't have been. The best three characters were Samuel L. Jackson, John C. Reilly, and John Goodman. Unfortunately, Goodman was completely underused, and Jackson was being created too much as a villain, which didn't work for me, but he was awesome in the role. Reilly was awesome, period. This film was a Woody Harrelson film. He could have played any of those three roles, or the Hiddleston role, too. With that stated, the last 70 minutes are generally a great big budget, splendid B-movie time, and fortunately, that saves the film from the lousy first 50 minutes. Even with two lousy leads, I'd give it a 3 out of 4 stars. Unfortunately, the four characters in the reel after the credits were the least interesting of all the characters in the film, in my opinion. And that's it.
Yeah. Well, Phil was even harsher on the characters than I was. I loved the monsters in the movie. Didn't really like the characters except for John C. Reilly. But I think the enjoyment of the monsters well outweighs the dislike of the characters. It is monster porn. I do agree that it is a spectacle movie and you should try and catch it on the big screen. Because this Kong is something to behold when he's 30 feet tall, in front of your eyes on a screen. So yeah, go check it out in the theaters. And I think, we would all agree that this movie is not perfect, but is highly enjoyable, and in for the podcast as a whole is a recommend.
Absolutely. All right, good. Continue.
So, unless anybody has anything else to chime in with, I'm going to lead us out.
No, I'm good. I'm good.
You're good, Phil. You haven't been around.
No. Nope,
anything else to say?
No. I'm sure you guys picked up on all the various points. So I even heard in the distance because the microphone was loud enough that I could hear you guys a little bit. And I heard Mike mention how they had to recast people and stuff. And that was good points that he brought that up. And I also heard him mention the Chinese character, too, which was good as well. So pretty much everything was hit on, I'm sure.
Yep. All right, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Listen to us talk about Kong Skull Island this week. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.